Wednesday, June 8, 2016, you are listening to the Daily Dose Sports Podcast, and I am your host, Clint Daly, sports writer from Denver, Colorado. You know, we release new podcasts every single Wednesday and bring you our own unique outlook on the world of sports. You can find us pretty much anywhere that podcasts are hosted, whether that is iTunes, Stitcher. If you're not a, you know, you're not an Apple person, you're not an iTunes person, you can always go to Podcast Republic. You can go to Google Plus. And of course, you can always head over to rogueintel.com and listen to the podcast there. Daily Dose is a proud member of the Rogue Intel Podcast Network. While you are at rogueintel.com, you might want to check out some of the other podcasts that are over there. You are sure to find something that you are going to enjoy. If you would like to contact the show for any reason, you know, you've got something on your mind, you've got something you would like to say, we do get some emails, we do get some tweets that every once in a while we'll read on the show, and we try to put together a few emails. You know, a few of your comments and read your emails at some point over the summer. We try to get to that. If you would like to drop us a line, feel free to send it to us. You can hit us at dailydosesports@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter or on Facebook. Both of those handles are at Daily Dose Sports. And you can head over to our website, dailydosesports.wordpress.com. We do put up a new article every single week, try to get something up fresh and new for you each week. You might want to go over and check that out this week. We did have something go up on the NBA Finals, something that you might be interested in checking out. This week on the show, you know, we are going to be joined today by former world-class boxer Frankie Sanchez to discuss the legacy of Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali, of course, passed away at 74 years of age on Friday. We are also going to be discussing the NBA Finals today. And who might be even more upset about the Golden State Warriors winning than Charles Barkley, who we discussed last week? You know, last week we talked a little bit about, you know, a few things, who's most likely to in these finals. You know, and one of the things we talked about was that Charles Barkley is going to be really, really upset if the Golden State Warriors win. He keeps picking against him. He's been picking against him for 2 years. I've got someone who might be even more upset than Chuck. And of course, we will get to our Daily Dose Top 5, always a popular segment on the show. You never want to leave. You never want to check out early. You got to stick around for the Daily Dose Top 5. You never know which way it's going to go. You know, I know it's still a few months away. I know it's still a little bit off, but we start thinking about it this time of the year. We start thinking about a couple things, but there's a few things going on in the world of college football. There are a few schools that are going through some pretty significant offseason problems right now. Of course, Baylor fired their head coach, Ed Briles. They also fired their president, Ken Starr, amid a major scandal that saw these two clowns, apparently, they were failing to deal with players in the football program that were out committing sexual assaults. Like the players at Baylor were running around like they were like Vikings at some point. I don't know what exactly is going on down at Baylor, but apparently there were a number of sexual assaults taking place down at Baylor. And these two morons were either, they knew about the incidents and they were hiding them, or they were completely clueless and they have no idea what was going on. Either way, they shouldn't be leading young people of any kind. Now, it still has to be determined if the school is going to get any punishment from the NCAA or, you know, the state of Texas Department of Criminal Justice. At what point is the school liable? Like, you were hiding these things? You were keeping these things from getting out? We'll see where that all ends up. But keep in mind, Baylor, a school, having a little bit of off-season issues. Ole Miss is also in some trouble. We talked about Ole Miss a few weeks ago with the NFL draft taking place. And you know, of course, Laramie Tunsil coming out and saying, you know, he had some coaches paying some bills for him. He had some coaches paying some bills for his mom. Well, the NCAA notified Ole Miss of at least 13 alleged violations, including giving money to players for hotels, for cell phones, for loaner cars. And then, after the NCAA suspended and fired some of their assistant coaches, they told them, you got to get rid of these guys. You got to suspend these guys. Coaches all under Hugh Freeze. They fined them a pretty significant amount of money. And they pulled, I think it was 11 scholarships from Ole Miss. Ole Miss was like, hey, we want a self-report. Hey, our bad. We got this, though. Don't worry about it. We got this. Yeah, nice try, Ole Miss. Good try. I mean, way to put yourself out there after you've already been caught. It's like the little kid getting caught with his hand in the cookie jar. Hey, oh, mom caught me. Hey, I just want to let you know. I just want to let you right now, I did indeed, I was putting my hand in the cookie jar, but I didn't take anything. There wasn't, you know, no foul was committed here. No crime was committed here. And I just want to let you know, I kind of accidentally had my hand in the cookie jar. Yeah, except for that I caught you and we know exactly what you were doing. Nice try, Ole Miss. So Ole Miss is in trouble. We've got Baylor so far. We've got Ole Miss in trouble. Last team I want to talk about is Mississippi State. Because somehow, this isn't easy, somehow Mississippi State has managed to embarrass college football. Now, think about that for a second. Think about that for just 1 second. That's pretty amazing when you stop and think about it. Somehow Mississippi State have embarrassed college football just a little bit. Like, the pool was already kind of empty. Like, we know the filthiness and the corruption, and they've managed to drain just a little bit more out of that pool. But it seems that the Bulldogs' top freshman recruit, Jeffrey Simmons, was involved in a dispute with a woman that was having an issue with his sister. Wasn't having an issue with him, was having an issue with his sister. He apparently, the woman ended up on the ground. And so the 6'2", 235-pound defensive end punched the woman a few times while she was on the ground. So what is Mississippi State going to do, you know, with their young five-star recruit? What are they going to do to teach this young man a lesson? He is going to be suspended. That'll teach him. He's going to be suspended. You punch females, we're going to suspend you. We don't put up with your tomfoolery. We're going to suspend you. They're going to suspend him for one game. Well done, Mississippi State. Nicely done. Now, these three schools, a lot of problems in the offseason. A lot of problems in college football. A lot of problems going on in these three. Think about where these schools are at. And I'm telling you right now, you've got some pretty serious issues. You've got some guys doing some, beating up on women. You've got paying for players. You've got some kind of nasty things going on the campuses of these three schools. Now, the reason that I bring this up, because we know there's filthy things going on, but I'm telling you right now, with where these schools are located, there is a school that just might benefit from all this mess. There is a school that might take advantage of all the dirt being thrown around, all the things we see that are horrible that are going on. And that school just might be the University of Texas. Because, you know, Charlie Strong runs a pretty clean program. At least he always has. We haven't seen these issues. Believe it or not, Art Briles with Baylor, we saw some issues even back when he was coaching at the high school level. He had guys getting into trouble for steroids. He had guys out partying, guys getting in trouble. That's not completely new. We know what the Mississippi schools have been involved in. We know the Mississippi schools don't always run the cleanest thing. The program that might benefit the most from all this mess is the University of Texas. Sorry, Oklahoma fans. Sorry, Sooner. I don't know how it's done. But think about that. All these kids that were sitting there saying, hey, want to go to Baylor, want to go to Ole Miss, want to go, where could they end up? These schools may have recruited kids that now want to go somewhere else. They may have had their foot in the door on kids, talented kids, that want to go somewhere else. And I know that the Texas Longhorns would be glad to help them out. I'm telling you right now, University of Texas is going to be back in the national championship picture, at least contending in the next few seasons. Now, that might have happened anyways. That might have been heading that direction anyways because of the way Charlie Strong runs business. But this certainly doesn't hurt. He's got some schools not too far from him all doing really, really stupid things. Really stupid things. Talked about it just a minute ago. Can you think of who might be more mad than Charles Barkley about the NBA Finals? Talked about it a little bit last week. Chuck keeps picking against Golden State, talking about how a jump shooting team can't win the NBA championship. Well, they're not really a jump shooting team, but I understand what you're saying. You know, and we did talk a little bit about the Chuckster. I've been hating on the Warriors now for two straight years, but someone has to be even more mad than Charles Barkley. We'll tell you who that is in just a few minutes. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Hi guys, Cooper here from the Unquote Podcast. Unquote delves into what makes movie quotes so, well, quotable. See, I have a guest each week watch a movie selected from the American Film Institute's Top 100 Movie Quotes list, and then we sit down and ponder cultural impingement and cinematic preponderance, and okay, you got me, my thesaurus was totally open. A little factual and a lot of fun, it's the least contentious peanut gallery in history. Unquote is part of the Rogue Intel Network, and you can find me on iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter.
Dear podcast listener, we accept the fact that we have to sacrifice not only our Wednesdays, but our Fridays as well to entertain you. But we think you are crazy to make us do a promo telling you who we think we are. When you listen to our podcast, you think you know who we are, in the simplest terms, in the most convenient definitions. But what we found out is that each one of us is a dork.
I had the basket case, and I'm a princess.
And I'm a pothead.
Does that answer your question? Sincerely yours, The Prime Podcast. Find out more at theprimepod.com. Think of the tender
things that we were working on. Did you come up with who might be more upset about the way the NBA Finals are going right now than Charles Barkley? Because I'm telling you right now, if there's anyone more upset with how this Finals is going than the Oklahoma City Thunder, I don't know who it is. Think about this. They had the Warriors down 3-1. That series looked like it was over. That series looked like, hey, they could be rolling the Cavaliers too. You don't think Oklahoma City is looking around saying, hey, we could be doing the same thing. We could be making them look just as bad. You know, I'm looking at Cleveland right now. I'm watching the Cavaliers in these first two games. And I'm wondering, because we talked about this going into, the East is so down and the East is so bad. When you think of the teams that the Cavaliers beat just to get here. I mean, it really is. It's kind of embarrassing, isn't it? I mean, they beat the Pistons. They beat the Atlanta Hawks. They swept both of those teams. Then they had the Toronto Raptors, where we're looking at the Toronto Raptors like they stole two games from Cleveland. Okay, maybe Toronto's better than what we think. Here's the thing that I just want you to kind of think about. Who could the Cleveland Cavaliers beat in the West? Like, okay, we obviously know how they're doing against the Golden State Warriors. Like that, so far that hasn't been a competition. Could they beat Oklahoma City? I don't think so. Could they beat the San Antonio Spurs? Probably not. I think the Spurs would be too good defensively. Could they beat the Clippers? Maybe they could beat the Clippers. We know the depth might be a problem. Could they beat the Portland Trailblazers? I don't know. Possibly. But what we're seeing in these finals, at least so far, what we have is we have two teams that are pretty good offensively. One looks like they're quite a bit better. And then we have one that is good defensively. And then one that is not very good defensively. The Cleveland Cavaliers don't look like a very good defensive team. That is probably the biggest thing that has stood out to me about this series so far is how bad Cleveland is defensively. And I had thought, you know, going into the series, hey, Tyronn Lue, remember he had talked about some of the things we got to do. We got to get better defensively. We got to become a better rebounding team. We got to be more of a physical team. Some of those things. Not seeing that. I'm not sure I have ever seen two players get beat on backdoor cuts and slip screens the way that Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love consistently do possession after possession after possession. The Warriors are up 2-0 in two games that realistically have not been that close. Game one was not that close. I think it ended up being, I don't know, 15, 17, something like that. But it didn't feel that close. Game two felt like a 60-point game. And here's the problem. They're not getting anything from Klay Thompson and Steph Curry. I mean, we have to think they're going to get something going at some point, don't we? And Cavs coach Tyronn Lue, I'm going to be honest. Some of the adjustments he's made has kind of left me scratching my head. He's tried to slow things down. That doesn't really work because that just means you get less shots. The Warriors are still getting their shots, and if you're going to slow things down, then that means you've got to knock everything down, and you can't turn the ball over because you're getting less possessions. So what they've done so far is they've slowed things down, still turned it over, still missed shots, and then Golden State goes down and knocks their shots down. So that hasn't worked at all. They've tried switching screens, which hasn't worked because then Golden State is excellent at finding mismatches. When you see situations like Steph Curry singled up with Kevin Love, you know we had to switch a screen, and now you've got yourself in some big trouble. Kevin Love is a really, really bad defender. We have seen the Cleveland Cavaliers try going underneath all the screens. They don't want to go over the top of all the screens because they're worried about giving up the layup. That's screen comes. If I go over the top of it and you cut to the basket, then it's kind of like, you know, chasing someone playing tag. They cut to the basket and they're open. So Tyronn Lue actually had the Cavaliers going under all the screens. Ugh, man, seriously? Against Golden State, one of the greatest shooting teams ever, you decided to go under screens and allow them to shoot the basketball. Seriously? I mean, I know it just looks like Tyronn Lue is completely out of his league. Like Steve Kerr is coaching at one level and he is coaching at a whole different level. Like it's not even fair. It's not even close to being the same right now. This has been a painful series to watch. And I'm sitting here like hoping for an entertaining series. Like, honestly, I don't care who wins. It's going to be entertaining for me either way. I'm going to have something to talk about either way. I don't really have a dog in this fight. I'm just hoping for an entertaining series. And so far, it has been anything but entertaining. It has been pretty brutal to watch because Cleveland doesn't look like they can compete. They don't look like they even belong in this series. It kind of looks like we already saw the championship take place, and that was between Golden State and Oklahoma City. This doesn't look like the championship. This looks like those Super Bowls back in the 90s when it was between either like the Dallas Cowboys or the San Francisco 49ers. But whoever got to the Super Bowl, we already knew was going to win it in a blowout fashion because they already went through the biggest dog that was out there. Oh, we get to play the Buffalo Bills again? Thanks for that. Sorry, Buffalo Bills fans. Sorry about that. That's kind of what this looks like, though. It just looks like, yeah, the big dog was actually on your same side of the conference. So we talked a little bit last week about this is another legacy series for LeBron James. Now, I realize we still have four games to go. Or five games to go, sorry. They've played two. We still have five games to go. I have a hard time coming up with a way that Cleveland can win one game right now, let alone win four games, and they would have to win four of those five games to get back in the series. So I know we're jumping the gun a little bit. I don't want to say this series is over. It certainly feels over. It certainly feels like they should call it after three, but you know, we'll wait and see how this plays out. But how does this affect LeBron's legacy? I heard Jerry West talking last week and saying, hey, you're crazy if you think this affects the way we look at LeBron James. LeBron James is one of the great players. Well, you know, last year, all we heard was that it was because Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love were out. They were hurt. They were injured. LeBron was out there with a bunch of scrubs. They had to carry him. He had the J.R. Smith. He had a banged up Iman Shumpert. He had Matthew Dellavedova out there that he was trying to win with. What now? I mean, that's not the case this year. They've been loaded. And going into the series, all we heard was, hey, it's going to be a little bit different deal. This is going to be a little bit different than it was last year. Because now LeBron has all his weapons. It's going to be a little bit different. Yeah, it's going to be a little bit worse. If that's what you mean, if by different you mean worse, then yes. It's very, very different. I told you last year, and I've told you going into this year, I thought losing Irving and Love was the best thing that could have happened to Cleveland a year ago because it made them be a better defensive team and it forced them to pound the ball into the paint and stop settling for these dumb outside shots that they keep taking. It's kind of looking like that's the way this is all going, isn't it? I think the lesson that we can take away from the NBA Finals, at least thus far, is that LeBron James is a very good player. Very good player. He's not a Michael. I have a hard time saying he's a Bird or a Magic. He's not a killer. He's not a guy that's going to go out in a game and find that play that's going to break your back. He's not that guy. We keep trying to tell everyone he's that guy. The media keeps forcing that on. He's that guy. He's that good. He does never play that way. And I'm not looking at him saying, hey, if he ends up this year, if he loses this, he's going to be 2-5 in the finals. I'm not looking at it and saying, well, he's a big loser. That's not necessarily what I'm looking at. But he's just not the alpha dog in the pack. Jordan, we know. But even Magic and Larry and some of those guys, they found ways. They found ways. I don't want to hear the excuses. We're already starting to hear them this year. Well, his supporting cast isn't that good. Maybe he's just not a killer. Here's the one thing I do know for certain. Wherever you want to rate him, whatever you want to put him, I know this. He's not a very good general manager, is he? I think that's the biggest thing we've learned, is that letting LeBron pick the team, remember, this is his team. He assembled it. And I kind of get the feeling like he's coaching it half the time. He's not a very good general manager. The difference is that in Miami, when he was down with Miami, remember, he was going to go down there and they were going to win 6, maybe 7, maybe 8, and then they, you know, won 2. The difference was he had Pat Riley putting the pieces together for him. Now you let him come here, he's putting these pieces. At some point, I got to throw some of this blame on him and say, yeah, your picks haven't panned out. Remember, he picked Kevin Love. He wanted Kevin Love. That was going to be it. Now we're all we hear about is, well, they haven't figured out how to use Kevin Love. How have you not figured out how to use him yet? You still don't know how to use Kevin Love? Come on now. These are excuses. I have a great new idea for the new Space Jam. You know, a couple weeks ago, we had John from California. He came in and talked some baseball. And we were talking about the new Space Jam movie. And there's rumors at least out there that for the new Space Jam movie, maybe LeBron is going to be starring and taking the role of Michael Jordan. Here's my idea. Here's where I think this could all be going. Where could the new Space Jam movie be going? This is where I think it's going. LeBron's team loses to the Monstars, and then everyone blames Tweety Bird and Sylvester and, like, I don't know, Elmer Fudd for not carrying more of the load and doing more to help LeBron win. Doesn't that kind of seem how the new Space Jam is going to have to go? Because that's all we've seen for the past few years. It seems like it just keeps happening again and again and again. As promised, we are joined right now on the Daily Dose Hotline by former world-class boxer and mixed martial arts fighter. He has been a sports manager. He's been a promoter. He's also been a trainer. Denver, Colorado native, Frankie the Educator Sanchez. Welcome back to the Daily Dose. Frankie, I appreciate you joining us today.
Not a problem at all. It's great to be back.
You know, Frankie fought 32 pro fights. He fought for 3 professional championships. He fought some world-class fighters. And, you know, when we need some insight on the fight game, he's a great source to go to. He's always kind enough to join us here at the Daily Dose. Frankie, I'll be honest. I wish you were joining us under a little bit better circumstances. I wish we were talking about a big fight coming up. But with the passing of heavyweight champion Muhammad Ali, I wanted to have you on and just kind of pick your brain a little bit on the life of one of the most significant figures, not just in sports. I mean, this guy kind of transcended sports. One of the most charismatic, inspiring, and even polarizing figures in you know, not just sports, like I said, but kind of in the world. Muhammad Ali passes away at the age of 74. You know, just as a fighter, just to you, what did Muhammad Ali kind of mean to you just as a kid growing up?
Oh, wow, you know, just the name Muhammad Ali in itself, Cassius Clay, it's hard to digest that he's no longer with us. He's such an ambassador of the sport. No matter what kind of sport you like, soccer, football, baseball, you know the name Muhammad Ali.
Yep.
Everyone's known him since we were kids. And, you know, for him to pass was truly upsetting to me. And just, you know, it's even hard to speak a little bit about it. I haven't talked much about it, but he definitely was an influence to me. And I know kids in different sports who I grew up with mimicked him, mimicked his, fancy footwork, the shoe shine. It was weird, but... yeah, I mean, definitely, like you said, he was much more than just a great boxer. He was definitely ambassador of the sport worldwide. Everyone knew him. Didn't matter if you were in Africa, Australia, wherever you were, China, you knew who Muhammad Ali was, and that name will forever be known as, you know, the GOAT, the greatest of all time, in my opinion.
Sure, sure. Well, and like you said, it really is. It's kind of hard to quantify what he meant, because it wasn't just that he was a boxer. It wasn't just that he was a sports figure. I mean, like you said, you know, as far as race relations, as far as the civil rights movement, worldwide, he was a promoter of the sport. I don't know if he believed half of what he said, but he knew it drummed up business, and he knew it was good for his sport as an ambassador to the sport. I don't know if he actually believed everything that he said when he said it, though.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. And, you know, you either loved him or you hated him. And one thing Muhammad Ali knew what to do and how to do was to sell fights. And,
sure.
You know, he was it an act? Who knows? I mean, he was real big in civil rights and freedom for his people and giving back to the community. But you know, the way he did it, like I said, you either loved him or hate him. So you paid for, to go watch the fight to see him win, or you paid for him to hopefully watch him lose. But, yeah, you know, I'm a history major, and I always did research on great fighters. And a lot of people don't know that Muhammad Ali was more than just a fighter. You know, I graduated in 1999, or 1991. In 1990, a year before that, he negotiated the free with Saddam Hussein, had hostage, there was 15, I believe, hostage U.S. American
right.
Down there, and he negotiated the release of that. That's how much impact he had on the sport itself and with his country. I mean, they really believed in this guy, and, you know, to get Saddam Hussein to let these hostages go at a time of war by a fighter, a former world champion, is amazing. You know, so things like that people don't really understand what he did. You know, they didn't do some research, and he was just more than a crap talker and
right.
a great fighter. This guy did a lot for America and trying to make the civil rights better for everyone, you know.
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I was trying to think of, and the closest I can maybe get would be someone like Michael Jordan. I was trying to think of anyone that transcends sports like he did, because like you're talking about, it wasn't just sports, and you didn't have to be a sports person or a boxing person. People around the world know the name Muhammad Ali. I heard the story one time that he was on a flight, and he was looking down, and he goes, "Isn't it interesting that I could pretty much go to any of those houses down there that we see, and people would invite me in and have me in for dinner, have me as a guest, and they would love me, even though they don't know who I am. Everybody knows who I am." That's just the guy he was.
It was. I mean, you know, you got these towns in Africa when he fought George Foreman down there that they've never even had a radio or access to television, and they knew who he was.
And
Ali, you know, in the streets, running after his bus, trying to follow him like the Rocky movie when he was running, you know. And in Philadelphia, he had a group of kids following him. So yeah, I mean, you know who he was. I mean, I can recall the many, many, I guess you'd call them interviews/arguments with Howard Cosell. You know, I don't
right.
know if you remember those, but
yep.
it would go back and forth. And Howard would give him his opinion, and he'd give it right back. And there were times that I thought they were going to box on TV. But you know, those were some entertaining times, and people love to see that, you know. And everyone's going to miss it. I'm sure going to miss some of those interviews and, you know, his rhymes, his poems, everything he had was just amazing.
Well, and speaking of that, he kind of, if you wanted to talk about, you know, coming out of the 40s and 50s, you had so many athletes that they said the right thing. They were you know, trying to be, I say the right thing, I do the right thing, politically correct. Muhammad Ali came out and he said exactly what was on his mind, and maybe it was just to sell tickets, I don't know. But you want to talk about a guy that started the whole trash talk thing? This was the guy. Like, he called his shot, and then he backed it up.
Definitely did. I mean, you know, he would make fun about how ugly Joe Frazier was, how big and ugly George Foreman was. He'd tell them to their face, you know, "I'm going to knock you out in the sixth round."
Yep.
That's it. And you know, he would do it. He would he'd call the shots. You know, he'd let them know that he's going to shoe shine on them, and float like a butterfly, sting like a bee, and then he would do it. And that's one thing you got to give him credit for. He would back up most of the stuff that he talked.
Well, and one of the things that I think kind of gets lost, because it's a little bit difficult to rate Muhammad Ali, I think, as a fighter, because he does have a section of 4 years. In March of 1966, he refused to be inducted into the military. He was denied his boxing license, and he couldn't work for 4 years. He basically sat out four of his prime years. And because of that, it's a little bit harder to look at his entire career exactly where you rank him, because some of those years, we could have seen some really, really interesting things. We could have seen possibly him be at his best, but he did lose that time. It was a decision he made. I give him credit for that. And I know there's a lot of people out there, draft dodge or whatever. I give him credit because he stood for it, and it wasn't like he took off. It wasn't like he ran and hid. He said, "Nope, I'm not going to do it, and I'll stand here and I'll take my punishment like a man," and that's what he did.
Yeah, you know, and I was watching a special the other day about that, and you're absolutely right. I mean, retiring with a record of 56 wins and 5 losses, 37 KOs.
Yep.
That's an amazing record, and you are absolutely right. Taking 4 years off, I don't care what you do. If you're in the gym every day, if you're training with the best every day, it's not the same as getting fighting. So you're right. We don't know how good he really was, because those 4 years, I mean, yeah, maybe he could have lost, but you know, imagine that. Those were the prime years of his athletic career. And taking 4 years off, you're never the same after that. I don't care what sport you're in, football, you know, baseball. If you're a pro athlete at the top level and you take 4 years off, you're losing something. So, yeah, you're right. He he could have absolutely been, the best ever.
Yeah.
With having those 4 years back on his plate.
Absolutely, and you do wonder what that meant to him. I know that when he came back, obviously, he's a different fighter. He looks a little bit different. He moves a little bit different. Still had success. Still had some big wins and that kind of thing. But that was when we saw the loss to Frazier. That was when we saw the loss to Norton, and possibly maybe another loss to Norton. We won't maybe bring that up. But you know what I'm saying. He was a little bit past his prime when he came back. He lost 4 prime years, on a decision that he made. And like I said, he stood by it. Little bit of a clashing personality. And I wanted to get your input on this a little bit, because you were a great fighter. You understand the fight game. You understand what it takes to be a fighter. Muhammad Ali is a little bit different of a fighter. Like, just the way he moves, the things he does. Really, really talented, but they're not always the things like that you would teach a fighter to do, were they?
Right, exactly. And, unfortunately, because of that, resulted in him getting, a lot more brain damage, and after that, Parkinson's disease. But, and it does, it's just frustrating, because the fight game is not just all about who's the better fighter.
Sure.
Believe it or not, the trash talking before, it does really have an effect on some fighters. I mean, some of these fighters, such as George Foreman, Sonny Liston, would get so mad,
yep,
that they forgot about their game plan once the bell rang, because all they wanted to do was knock his head off. And you've seen that when he started the rope-a-dope, when he started grabbing on to him, looking at the crowd, talking to the crowd. It really frustrated these fighters. And as a fighter, once your game plan's out the door, you're in a world of hurt if you don't protect yourself. And that's what these fighters would do. They had a plan. They said, I'm not going to let this trash talking get to me. So what if he talked about my wife? So what if he talked about my mom? I'm going to go in there and I'm going to knock his head off. And, the whole game plan, when they got in there, it changed. Once they learned how fast he was and how slick he was, he'd stick his tongue at him, move. They, swung with everything, and he wasn't there to be hit. So you're right. I mean, it frustrated a lot of fighters. And I think at least half of his fights were won before the bell rang, because these guys were already so frustrated and so mad at the world that they were going to destroy him. And that all changed once the bell rang.
No, I think you're exactly right, and it is interesting, because you would see him go into these fights. He does things kind of unorthodox. I mean, dropping his hands, putting his face out towards you. The way, and you know this more than anyone, you're taught to kind of feint punches. He didn't do that. He would yank his whole head back in a really unorthodox way, but it drove his opponent absolutely crazy that they couldn't get a hold of him. He's an interesting fighter. And at the same time, this was not a guy with a glass chin. This guy took the best punchers that I guess probably I've ever seen. I saw him take Foreman's best, and it didn't knock him down.
You're absolutely right. I watched a special on Foreman when I was younger, and he was hitting the bag. George Foreman was such a big guy with big hands. He hit the bag. He actually put a dent in the bag, and it was a bag full of sand. And to do that, I mean, you could whack a Louisville Slugger on that bag
sometimes,
and it wouldn't put a dent in. I mean, George Foreman was truly one of the most hardest hitting heavyweights of all time. And for Ali to just, do to him what he did, it was amazing, because getting hit by one of those punches in the body or in the chin would destroy him, possibly kill some men, So. Yeah, the guy was amazing. Like I said, he would, shoe shine. He would rope a dope. He would hold on to the rope. He'd spin him. I mean, he'd stick his tongue out there, and right before they hit him, he'd move back and then come up with an overhand right. I mean, his skills, his boxing ability, and his hit and not be hit skills were just some of the best I've ever seen. The only one who might even come slightly in comparison to him would be Mayweather, but, that's a different story.
Right, because we did see Ali, like we said, talk about take some of the hugest hits. Mayweather just never gets touched. He was that guy where he just avoided the contact. Here's a question, and it's a little bit maybe hard to answer. How would he be received today as a fighter today with all the social media and with all the nonsense they have to deal with today? Do you think he would be able to adapt? Do you think he would be that kind of guy?
I don't know. It's a good question. You never know, because social media, spread so fast that you don't know if people would, like I said, they'd either like him or they hate him, but
yeah.
Yes, I guess he'd be okay, just like the Mayweather. I mean, Mayweather does kind of the similar game, the talking,
sure.
And he backs it up, though, and I don't know if Muhammad Ali would have so much, buy 15 Rolls Royce and $2 million watch, but
right.
I think that, I think he'd be taken. I think he'd be half and half again. Half of the fans would love him, half of them would hate him, they'd order the fights just to see him get his butt kicked, or at least hope for that. So,
right.
It don't know, but no one has ever seen that. If in his time frame, no one has ever seen that kind of trash talking, and And like I said, you're getting a white family from the suburbs or, you know, somewhere, and they hear this African-American guy talking like that. I'd like to see what happened. You know, I'd like to say, well, shoot, I've never seen someone talk like this, and he's rhyming. He's basically rapping against these guys. He's, making poems against these guys. He's making them so mad that I'd like to see what happened. So I think that he gained a lot of fans that way. And then when he was backing it up, they either loved him after that or they hated him, you know, because it looked like someone say he'd be showing off. Someone say that, no, he's just that good. But he still has a lot of fans, love him or hate him, you know.
Yeah, and there's no question that he would sell tickets. He just was that kind of personality. You, like you said, you wanted to see, is he going to get beat, or is he the guy? I go back to, you know, when he fought Sonny Liston the first time, and Liston came charging across the ring, and you know, I'm going to knock this kid out, and it's going to be over, and you know, slides over, moves his head a few times, dusts him up a couple times, and Liston is like, uh-oh, I'm in for a long fight. He was an interesting fighter. I don't know exactly where I rank him all time. I understand the sentiment of ranking him best ever. There's a couple other guys that stand in there that I would be tough. It would be tough for me to move aside, but I understand it because he was a great fighter. It's always tough to compare eras, but that's kind of why we do what we do, because it's kind of fun to talk about. Where would you rank him all time? All fighters across the board.
In all honesty, I'd have to give him at least the top 10. I can't say he was the best of all time because he got beat. And, you know, part of the boxing game is, you know, not being beat. You got guys like Rocky Marciano who retired undefeated.
Sure.
So, you know, and these guys fought a lot, but, you know, maybe top 5, top 10 at least. I mean, you know, he fought guys like Ken Norton. I mean, Joe Frazier. You know, and I remember him. I was born in 72, but I remember watching films when him fighting Floyd Patterson. These are some of the best fighters of all time. You know, George Foreman, Ron Lyles. I mean, there's so many guys, you know, just average guys, Jimmy Young, you know, Richard Dunn. There's so many, and I don't know if you remember Ernie Shavers.
Yep, absolutely.
He also fought, you know, the Sphinx. He fought Holmes.
Yep, he fought Leon.
He fought Leon twice,
I think.
Top heavyweights of all time. Ken Norton, I don't know if you remember that fight. It was at Yankee Stadium.
Yep.
You know, I mean, and I don't know if that was a sellout or what. I don't remember, but I remember hearing about that fight on the radio, you know?
Sure.
And, of course, always, rest in peace, Ron Lyle. Ron Lyle from Denver was, you know, had fought Muhammad Ali, and I remember that because I knew Ron as a coach, and I talked to him about 2 months before he passed away here in Denver. But, I mean, he would tell me that, you know, Muhammad Ali hit very hard, and he was so fast, and he couldn't believe how, for a heavyweight, how he moved like a lightweight. You know, that was awesome, and, the exhibition that he had at the old Mile High Stadium with Lyle Alzado.
I remember that.
I wish I could have attended that, but I always heard about these things, how magnificent the guy was. And, you know, like I said, he's on my list, and I have a tough list. He's easily in the top 10 of the greatest.
Sure. Ever. No, and I can see him being, you know, top three. Joe Louis is going to be on my list. Sugar Ray Robinson is going to be on my list. Like you said, Marciano's going to be up in there somewhere. But it's fun to talk about, and it's fun to compare those eras and that kind of thing. Now, here's one thing that people may not know, and one thing that I definitely want to make sure that people are aware of. You actually had the chance to meet Muhammad Ali, not once, but twice. Tell me this just a little bit. You met him. Where were you at when you met him?
Well, the first time I met him, and I wasn't too sure I was going to meet him, but during my pro career in 2003, I got offered to fight for the WBA, World Boxing Association, North American Association title against a kid out of New York by the name of Chris Smith. He's a Jamaican kid that was just an amazing Golden Glove champ, couple-time national champ, and he had a great professional career. So I fought him on the undercard of Layla Ali versus Christy Martin.
Oh, yeah.
And it was amazing because, you know, everyone saying, well, is Muhammad going to make it? You know, he's a little sick right now, but he's going to make it or not. So either way, I knew it was going to be good publicity. And, you know, like I said, it was Layla Ali and Christy Martin were the main event, and Wolf, and I forgot who she fought, were the co-main, and I was the headliner of the male part of the card. So it was awesome. Muhammad Ali was in the front row. I saw him getting in the ring, and you talk about being nervous. You have one of the greatest fighters of all time there. So, you know, it was just great. After the fight, I went and just, you know, shook his hand and told him thanks for being there and good luck to his daughter, Layla. And, you know, during the whole press conference and everything, he wasn't there, but I got to meet Layla Ali, which she's just a beautiful person. I mean, her beauty outside and inside is amazing, kind of like him, you know, and she had the same charisma like him. She people were flocking to her. It was amazing. But, you know, being on the same card as her in a record-breaking attendance at the Biloxi, Gold Coast Coliseum, I guess, right before the Hurricanes came.
Okay.
It was great. I mean, I believe they had like 17 to 20,000 people in attendance, and it was, like I said, on pay-per-view television. But to have him there was everything. I mean, all I can say is he at least heard my name because, you know, when they announce your name, you know who's fighting. And so
sure.
That was great to see him in the front row. But it was a little nervous for me.
Oh, I bet.
That was the first time. And I was like, dang it. At the time, you know, we didn't have the smartphones. You know, this was back in 2003. So I didn't get to get the picture. But a few years later, 2008 or 9, I was I got flown out by a nonprofit organization, a friend of mine, Fred Morales, who runs this. They raise money for youth, try to get them to college. I went and did a motivational speech for them in Oxnard, California. Well, on my way back, you know, flying out of the L.A. airport, I look over and I see a guy in a wheelchair, and I'm like, what the hell is that? Who I think it is? So he's in a wheelchair, got his sunglasses on, and I look at his wife, and she has this African kind of it's African, I guess you'd call it like a scarf on her head.
Okay.
And so I knew it was her right away. I look over, and I'm like, there's like a couple people, but no one's going up to him. So I was like, that got to be Muhammad Ali. I said, I got to talk to him. I got my camera ready, and I didn't want to go and, you know, let the crowd know and everyone start flocking to him. So what I did is I went over there, and there was a gentleman there, and I said, hey, you with Ali Party? He's like, yeah, I'm his nurse. I'm like, hey, do you think he'd mind getting a picture? And he's like, you know, absolutely, he would right now because, you know, we're just trying to get through the airport, and he just got back from a fundraiser in L.A., and, yeah, I'm like, he's like, I can't. I'm like, all right, man, well, I said, I fought on the undercard of his daughter a few years ago, and I would just didn't get a chance to get a picture. But, you know, if anything changes, just let me know. So I let it go. I didn't bug him.
Sure.
And what about, I start walking to my to the gate for my flight back to Denver, and this guy's running down the hallway. He's like, Frankie, come on back here. I was like, yeah, what's up? He's like, hey, man, I'm sorry. He goes, you know what? Talk to Ali. He said, no problem. Come and grab a picture. Everyone's going to probably start surrounding him, so I want you to go ahead and get a picture. So I walked up to him. They kind of wheeled him over. He was in a wheelchair to me, right kind of by the gate that they were going to go into. And, you know, I said, hey, Muhammad, I said, really appreciate you taking this picture. I fought on Layla Ali's undercard, your daughter, and, you know, I didn't get a chance to get a picture, but I would definitely love it for my collection. He's like, you know, no problem. And at the time, I put my fist up, you know, like to get a boxing pose.
Sure.
And the nurse says, come on, Muhammad, you know you can put your fist up. So he puts it up, and God bless his soul, he starts shaking a little bit, you know, because of the Parkinson's.
Right.
He puts it up, and I put on a big smile, and we had the nurse, his nurse, who was male, take the picture. And I told his wife, hey, thank you. I know you guys are going to get rushed now by everybody. But, yeah, then after I took the picture, you know, 50, 60 people around him, and, you know, they brought security over to clear it out. But I was so happy with that picture because, you know, that is, in my old time, got to be one of my top three pictures I've ever taken with anybody. So
sure.
It was so exciting to get that. And, you know, when I told everyone about it, they couldn't believe it until they saw the picture. So it was truly amazing.
Well, that is awesome. We're gonna have to get that picture and post it up on the Daily Dose so people can see that, because that really is an amazing story. And the cool thing about that story, you know, when you think back of Muhammad Ali's health, especially as of recent, you know that his mind was still sharp. Maybe he couldn't verbalize the thing that he wanted to, but you know that his mind was still sharp. You know that he still knew everything that was happening around him, and so there's no question that he knew what was going on. That's the reason you got the, you know, the call back to get that picture even taken. I want to say thank you so much for stopping by, sharing some memories, talking a little bit about the legacy of Muhammad Ali. He is someone that is going to be missed for sure. Just the things he did for boxing, for sports, for race. He meant so much to so many different people. I have to say thank you to Frankie for stopping by and talking with us. I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, not a problem, man. I appreciate it. Thanks for at least, you know, taking the time out to give this man the much deserved respect he needs. Because like I said, he wasn't just a great fighter. He was an ambassador of the sport. And he taught people more than anything just to be good to one another. Treat people well. You know, he wanted peace for the world, and you know, who knows? Maybe he got a little bit of that, and you know, he's not suffering from any more pain right now, and that's a good thing. I'm proud of. But like I said, I was so happy that I got a picture with him, and he signed a medal for me and my mom. And you know, it was great to meet one of the best fighters and one of the best people ever.
Sure.
It was truly an honor to me. So thanks for you know, calling me and letting me be part of the show.
Hey, Frankie, thanks so much. We'll hook up again. We got to hope for another big fight. Here's a question for you. I got to throw this out to you. Who in the world is the heavyweight champion right now? Can we please get a heavyweight in there that we know?
Yeah, I don't know. I know the Klitschko lost. I don't even follow the heavyweights anymore, but
that's
we need
brutal.
To get someone. What's his name? Deontay Wilder, I think, is up there. But yeah, we need to get
Tyson
someone.
Tyson Fury,
but,
I think, is out there.
Muhammad Ali, hopefully someday, you know?
Yeah, we got to get, the, you know, there's a little bit of something to watch at the middleweight, kind of that area, but boxing is so much fun when it's a heavyweight, you know, championship, and it's somebody that you care about, it's somebody that you know. Boxing is so much more fun when we do have the heavyweights to care about. When we have another big fight, I'll definitely be hitting you up and see if you can stop by the dose again.
Yeah, sure do, and like I said, I'll be out to see, hopefully, Floyd's at the gym, Mayweather, on Wednesday when I go out to his gym to see him. I'll have to pick his brain about what heavyweight he thinks is coming up, because he's more in the fight game now than I am, but I'll pick his brain about it if I see him, and I'll get back to you and let you know.
Pick his brain about this. Is he really going to fight Conor McGregor? Because now I'm hearing this actually is a realistic possibility. This isn't just talk.
You know what? Anything is possible when it comes to, $300-400 million.
Right.
So, I mean, I think if Conor McGregor was smart, he'd take the fight, even though he'd get...
Absolutely.
...pummeled, but why not take the fight and make money? Because it can happen. I'm gonna ask him when I'm out there if it's truly going to happen or not.
Well, I will be very interested to hear back on that, because there's a few fights out there that I'd like to see. I don't know if I would... I guess I would watch that one. It would be interesting, at least, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'd watch it, because I'd know the outcome. I'd probably put as much money as that in my bank account on Floyd Mayweather to win.
Floyd.
It would happen. There's no way he would lose.
Yeah, it's a different deal. It's just like if you tried to put him in the ring with McGregor and they were doing, you know, the MMA stuff, it just wouldn't be. It's just not fair. You're going onto someone else's turf.
Yeah, he wouldn't last 20 seconds with McGregor if it was mixed martial arts rules.
No. Well, hey, thanks again. I appreciate you stopping by. We will we'll definitely hook up again.
Sounds good, man. Have a great one.
Now, as we do every single week, we have got to get to our Daily Dose Top 5. Of course, you know, we spoke just now with Frankie. With the passing of Muhammad Ali, I decided we had to go with the top 5 defining moments for Muhammad Ali. You know, Ali was he was just this kind of contradiction all the time. I mean, when you think back to what he was, different guy to different people. You have a number of people that hated him. You had a number of people that said he was too cocky. He was too loud. You had another group of people that absolutely loved him. But he was a contradiction himself. He had kind of a clashing style about the things he did. You saw him with a guy like Joe Frazier. Cruel. The things that he said to Frazier. The way that he went about him in a personal way. Cruel. Mean. Mean-spirited. Some of those things you would never say to anyone. The way he treated him sometimes was kind of awful. The way the humanitarian side of him, especially later in life, it seemed like Muhammad Ali kind of loved everybody. You just saw a clashing personality. He just a lot of different facets to the personality that was Muhammad Ali. But like Frankie and I talked about, name another athlete that you could possibly compare him to. Another guy that touched people, not just in boxing, not just in sports, not just in America, worldwide, in political venues. It's absolutely amazing, the cult of personality that Muhammad Ali had. So today, we count down the Daily Dose top 5 defining moments for Muhammad Ali. Number 5 on our list. And this might be a little bit obscure. This might be a little bit odd. But number 5, I've got to put the 1996 Olympic Games. You know, to open the Olympic Games in Atlanta, the promoters that put together the Olympics kind of surprised everyone and had Muhammad Ali lighting the flame to start the Games. And the reaction of fans worldwide just showed how much attitudes about Muhammad Ali had completely changed. Remember, this is a guy that was hated at times back in the 60s. This was a guy who was so polarizing. Everyone had kind of found, you know, again, that humanitarian side of him. He was a good guy. This is a guy who stood up for civil rights. This is a guy who stood up for people who couldn't stand up for themselves. Everyone at the 96 Olympic Games loved Muhammad Ali. I mean, when he went up, you saw people, grown people, crying when they saw Muhammad Ali up there lighting the flame. Well, except for Joe Frazier. Because Joe Frazier and him never did mend that fence. In fact, Joe Frazier said when he saw Muhammad up there, if he had the chance, he would have pushed him into the flame. Joe Frazier still hates him as Muhammad Ali. Kind of speaks to the guy that he was, though. He was a little bit different. And you might have loved him. You might have hated him. Joe Frazier hated him. Might have been the only guy watching that telecast that wasn't, you know, just stunned and amazed and just looking at Muhammad Ali in awe. Joe Frazier was like, I'm good like that. I don't need any of that. That's got to be my number five moment. It's kind of a defining moment for him. The way people's attitudes have changed. Number four has to be his exile in March of 1966. You know, Muhammad Ali, we talked about it with Frankie. Muhammad Ali had refused to be inducted into the military. And while he was instantly unpopular with a number of people for being, you know, the draft dodger and a coward and all these kind of things, he was a man of principle, which endeared him to the other side. He couldn't work for 4 years. He had to go fight through court cases, trying to avoid prison and these kind of things. He lost some prime fighting years. He didn't duck it. He didn't dodge it. He didn't say, well, I'm going to go to Canada. I'm going to leave the country. No. In fact, what he did instead was he kind of became an advocate of, you know, the anti-Vietnam sentiments that were out there. He became a speaker for racial justice. He started to kind of change. It wasn't just about not wanting to go fight. You remember the famous statement that he had, where, you know, none of those Viet Cong, I never had a quarrel with any of those Viet Cong. That wasn't his issue. He didn't see any reason to go fight in a war that he didn't care anything about. But as a country, we kind of started to evolve towards that way of thinking too. Yeah, why are we over there fighting? What are we doing over there? And as a result, the cause that Muhammad Ali kind of started preaching kind of started to spin a little bit back here in the States too. And everybody started to say, well, yeah, maybe we are kind of wasting our time over there just playing political football and getting a lot of young people killed. Was he that far off? I don't know. But he stood up for what he believed, and him taking those 4 years out of his professional career, couldn't make money, couldn't fight, couldn't do those things, and then starting, like I said, to become a speaker in the civil rights movement, definitely a defining moment for Muhammad Ali. Number three on our list, it's got to be the Thrilla in Manila versus Joe Frazier. Now, you might not remember this, or maybe you're too young to know. Ali and Joe Frazier, they had fought their first fight. It was called the Fight of the Century in 1971. Frazier had won that. He had won it on a unanimous decision. I don't know that there was any controversy there. Frazier had won that fight. Ali had won the rematch, Ali-Frazier 2. This was kind of the rubber match. This was going to be, you know, the last one, and it is one of the greatest fights in the history of boxing. Go find it on YouTube. They've been showing it on all the ESPN channels. I know I call out ESPN a number of times and make fun of some of the stuff they do. They've actually done a phenomenal job showing some of these fights and showing some of the clips of Muhammad Ali after his passing, because this is a phenomenal fight. This is an excellent, excellent fight. Both guys severely injured. Both guys were hospitalized. Ali said later that he felt like he might die during that fight. Frazier had a horrible cut over his eye, though. And this was when they were going 15 rounds. At the end of the 14th, his corner looked at his eye. Now, Frazier was still bouncing. If you go watch this fight, Frazier still has some bounce in his step. He's still moving. He probably had Ali beat. He might have finished him in the 15th. His corner looked at his eye and said, there's no way. You're going to lose vision. You can't see anything. You can't see any punches coming from that side. So they threw in the towel and they stopped the fight. What they didn't know was that Ali had told his corner, if Joe answers the bell, I don't know if I can go on. I might have to quit. It might be over. Now, knowing Ali, I don't think he would quit. But I think it sometimes gets forgotten how tough he was. This was a tough guy. You know, we think about float like a butterfly, sting like a bee, and you think of the quotes and the quick feet, and that he took some big time punches and somehow held on to win the Thrill in Manila. That's absolutely a defining moment in his career. That is number three on our list. Number two, the 1974 Rumble in the Jungle versus George Foreman. Now, George Foreman, when you hear that name now, oh, he's cuddly George Foreman. He's the Foreman grill guy. That's not who he was back in 1974. George Foreman was the baddest dude on the planet. Like, nobody wanted to fight George Foreman. He was bigger. He was stronger. He could just hit like a ton of bricks. He's one of the biggest hitters ever in the history of boxing. And so what was Muhammad Ali going to do? He's not going to beat this younger, stronger, faster guy. There's no way. There's no way he's going to win this fight. Nobody wanted to fight Foreman. And then Muhammad Ali did something a little bit crazy. He went out there and he let Foreman hit him. Now, to be fair, he leaned against the ropes and he took most of those blows to the arms. Took a lot of blows to the shoulders. But he did take some pretty big shots from George Foreman. And Foreman's punching and punching and punching and punching and punching. And in the seventh, George Foreman did catch Ali with a hard, hard right hook. And when he did, he's thinking, maybe Ali's going to go down. Maybe I hurt him, because he caught him. He caught him on the jaw. Big hit. And Muhammad Ali said to him, George, is that all you've got? And George said that he thought to himself, yeah. Yeah, I think it is. I think that is all I've got. Ran out of gas. Punched himself out. Muhammad Ali knocked him out in the eighth round. It was over. Muhammad Ali wins the Rumble in the Jungle. That is number two on our list. The number one defining moment in Muhammad Ali's career, in Muhammad Ali's life, at least for me, at least where I'm going to rate this. I've got to put, because nothing, now when I say this, you're going to say, really? How is the Thrill Manila? How is the Rumble in the Jungle? How are those not number one? Because without number one, without this one, none of those take place. None of those happen. It has to be his first fight versus Sonny Liston in 1964. Speaking of guys who were the baddest dudes on the planet, Sonny Liston was the heavyweight champion for 2 years after knocking out Floyd Patterson not once, twice. He knocked out Patterson. And there were a lot of guys that wouldn't fight him. There were a number of fighters that were like, let me see how this whole Ali Liston thing turns out, because I don't want to fight Sonny Liston. He's a bad dude. Muhammad Ali, of course, at the time he was still known as Cassius Clay, talking trash, saying how he's going to knock him out, saying he's a big ugly bear, and when the big ugly bear gets in the ring with me, I'm going to knock him out. When the fight actually took place, this is what Frankie was talking about. A lot of these fighters were beat by the time they got into the ring with him. Liston comes charging across the ring. I'm going to knock this kid out, and I'm going to knock him out early, and it's going to be ugly. But he didn't realize the quickness, the elusiveness, too slick. Too skilled. And like we talked about, he wasn't like a textbook fighter. He'd put his hands down. He'd stick his jaw out. He did some goofy things that you would not teach young fighters to do. But Liston couldn't catch him. Liston couldn't catch him. And in the third round, he actually cut Liston a little bit above and a little bit below the eye. He hurt Liston. Had him staggered. If you listen to the crowd and the announcer, he's actually, I think he hurt Liston. I think Cassius Clay is winning this fight. But in the fourth round, now this is straight out of the movies. This is movie stuff. In the fourth, Ali comes back to his corner and he says, his eyes are burning. I can't see. I'm losing my vision. Well, you know, Sonny Liston had been accused in the past of putting stuff on his gloves, putting ointments and stuff on his gloves that might hurt his opponent's eyes. And so Ali's corner basically tells him, well, there's nothing we can do. Like, you're going to have to suck it up and fight, because it's either that or cut off the gloves and this fight's over. And he almost quit. He considered quitting. They're working on his eyes. They're trying to rinse his eyes, trying to get that off him. He ran around for the next couple of rounds just trying to hold on, just trying to get his vision back. And he said that he could just see shadows. He couldn't see a whole lot. He was trying to squint through and locate Liston, but Liston couldn't catch him. He couldn't catch him. And so Ali ran around for a round or two. He got his vision back. He could see again. He survived. And in the start of the seventh, Sonny Liston refused to answer the bell. And a young Muhammad Ali, at the time Cassius Clay, won the heavyweight championship. But again, if not for this fight, if he doesn't get by Liston, none of the other stuff ever gets a chance to happen. Controversial, polarizing. Absolutely incredible, incredible personality, though. That is the guy. That is the moment that wins our number one defining moment of all time in Muhammad Ali's career. Hey, I have to say thank you to Frankie Sanchez for stopping by and talking a little bit about his experiences with Muhammad Ali. Appreciate that so much. If you get a chance, head over to wherever it is that you listen to, you download, whatever it is that you get the podcast, just give us a quick 5-star rating and a review. That helps us so much. We would appreciate it. You got to stop by DailyDoseSports.wordpress.com. Check out the picture of Frankie Sanchez there with Muhammad. If you get a chance, head over to RogueIntel.com. We have a forum page over there. Some things are changing. Some things are getting kind of big over at RogueIntel.com. If you haven't been by there lately, you might want to stop by because we're just getting bigger and better at Rogue Intel. Have to say thank you to JSP. Could not do any of this without you. I will see you all next week. Have a great week, everybody.
I'm a bad man.